Star jump sequence terminates, Captain.
Get the gravitational dampers online and open the blast shield.
Aye, sir.
Bring us in closer.
Aye, aye, sir. Moving us in on sublight drive.
Extreme magnification.
Aye, sir.
The center of the galaxy. And there's our black hole.
The experience of a lifetime, Captain.
Let me put this on audio. You should be able to hear the magnetic resonance.
This is it, ladies and gentlemen. The edge of time and space, where the impossible can happen. Welcome to the event horizon.
Good morning, or afternoon, or evening, whatever is relevant for the part of the world you are in. Indeed, welcome to the Event Horizon, where the impossible happens. Join us each week at this time as we delve into the worlds of science fiction, fantasy, and science fact in all their forms. I'm your host, Gene Turnbow.
And I am your other host, Susan Fox.
And with us is a luminary in science fiction, Mark Scott Zacree. There's so much about you that I could tell, but I think it's probably better that you tell it yourself.
Sure, sure.
Welcome to the show, first of all.
Yes. Well, I mean, you described me as a luminary, and that means that, of course, when I'm in a dark room, I give off light, and so on people's electrical bills.
Put a small candle behind your head.
No, yeah. It's
the light
infrared.
Goes through the eyes.
It's infrared.
Well, I'm very lucky because I've had a sense of calling since I was very, very young. And, you know, Star Trek and Twilight Zone and Outer Limits were the original versions of those were the three shows that made me want to be a writer. And, you know, my first radio play appeared on KPFK when I was 18. And then I went to the Clarion Science Fiction Writing Workshop when I was 19, sold my first short story to Damon Knight, who actually was the writer who wrote To Serve Man, which was made into a terrific Twilight Zone episode. And right out of college, I started writing for animation, and I also started writing The Twilight Zone Companion. And then jumped, and so I wrote Smurfs, He-Man, Super Friends, Real Ghostbusters, Pole Position, The Littles, on and on and on. And then jumped over to live action with Captain Power and the Soldiers of the Future, which I developed for television, and then right into Friday the 13th, the series, Star Trek The Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Babylon 5, Sliders, on and on, until finally we are here, lo, these many years later, where I have my own studio, and I'm doing Space Command, and very, very soon I have five other series waiting in the wings. So
wow.
It's pretty amazing.
So what's it like to greenlight your own stuff for a change?
Well, it's great. It's great.
Yeah.
And in fact, I wrote a book recently called Greenlighting Yourself that's available on Amazon because, you know, you know, Gene, that I run a round table of writers and directors and actors and producers.
Mm-hmm.
Just it's called The Table, and it's just to create
a compassionate
community in the entertainment industry. And we've been running it every Thursday for 30 years, and we have thousands of members around the world. And I realized that a lot of the how-to books on how to make it in Hollywood, quote-unquote, were at the very least outdated, and at the worst were totally inappropriate to today's world, because they say, well, you just write a great script and you get an agent and blah blah blah, and this is not how it works anymore. And
that was true 30 years ago, maybe.
Yes,
certainly.
Yes, well, when I started in the industry, when I started as a writer, there were three networks and syndication, and that was the only game in town. If you wanted to write something that would reach millions of people, you needed a network and a studio, and even in books, you needed a major publisher. Now, none of that is the case. You can just set up your own YouTube channel, and if you've got content that interests people, you can reach millions of people around the world, which I have with my Mr. Sci-Fi channel on YouTube. And so between crowdfunding and selling investment shares for $7,500 each on Space Command, I was able to raise $4 million and open my own studio, which has three sound stages full of spaceship sets and giant robots and aliens and spacesuits. And it's a dream come true. And my wife and I write and produce and direct all of this stuff. And, we don't have to ask permission from anybody. We don't have to ask permission as to what we write or as to who we cast or to what we do. And I was very lucky in television. 95% of what I wrote got made. And the executives I dealt with usually were very intelligent people and were not meddlesome, but that's the luck of the draw. And a lot of my friends, their careers were stunted and blighted by stupid executives who didn't understand science fiction, certainly didn't understand good writing. And, I didn't have much of an axe to, I wasn't full of complaints, but I thought I very much prefer this way of doing things than writing for the studios and the networks. This is much more fun.
Oh, I can imagine. Do you find that not having a studio looking over your shoulder can be a detriment in some ways?
No, not at all. The it's good to get feedback. It's good to make sure that what you're doing works. But we don't say that with book writers. We don't say, well, gee, shame rotten. Ray Bradbury didn't have somebody looking over his shoulder and telling him that that book about the guy who burns books is a stupid idea. Why write that book? It's like, no, we trust that the writer has intelligence and passion, and we're fascinated by their body of work. So with someone like Ray Bradbury, if it's Fahrenheit 451 or Martian Chronicles or something Wicked This Way Comes, we go where he wants to go. We follow his interests because we love his work and we're interested and we're part of that journey. In television, however, some of the best shows are never made because, for instance, Ron Moore, one of the great writer showrunners in television. He came off Star Trek The Next Generation, reinvented Battlestar Galactica, did Outlander, and now For All Mankind. And yet he recently had a four-year development deal with one of the studios, and nothing got made. So he was writing and writing and writing and writing, and that never got anywhere. Now, maybe eventually someone will greenlight some of that stuff. But, if he had the same authorial power that a book writer had, that wouldn't have happened. He would have been able to make those shows, and then it would be up to the audience whether or not they were, they worked. But again, I just want for myself and for my friends who are TV writers to have the same authorial voice as book writers.
Tell us about the writers.
Tell you about the writers? Mean the writers that I'm working with?
Yeah.
Or the writers that I know? I was very, very lucky because I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and so the people I was reading were the greats of the golden age of science fiction. So it was Ray Bradbury and Theodore Sturgeon and Roger Zelazny and Chip Delaney and Samuel R. Delaney and Joe Haldeman. And they became friends and mentors, Harlan Ellison. And so when I was a teenager, I started, because I noticed the same names were writing the TV shows I loved, Star Trek, Twilight Zone, Outer Limits, those were the same names as on the books I was reading, Theodore Sturgeon, Harlan Ellison, George Clayton Johnson, on and on, Charles Beaumont, Richard Matheson. So as soon as I was old enough to go to science fiction conventions, I was able to meet these writers, and they became friends and mentors. That then led to me writing the Twilight Zone Companion, in which I was able to really study Serling and Matheson and Beaumont and George Clayton Johnson, these amazing writers. And by then I was also writing for TV. Now, the other second part of that is that I was fortunate enough to grow up in the golden age of literary science fiction and the beginning of the great golden age of science fiction television and film with 2001 and so forth. But I also came up in the generation of the great science fiction showrunners. So just the people I was dealing with as friends and on a day-to-day basis were people like J. Michael Straczynski and Ron Moore and Brandon Braga and George R. R. Martin and Harlan Ellison again, Rockne O'Bannon, who created Farscape. These are people that were just sort of the people I was knowing and dealing with, and my friends Mark Fergus and Hawk Ostby, who developed the Expanse and ran that show, so I know all these people, primarily the TV showrunners. I do know some people in film, but it's not as deep a bench. I wrote a book with Guillermo del Toro recently. They're going to have a new edition of it coming out, so I know Guillermo. But my main circle was the science fiction TV writers. And we were all very much, first of all, for all of us, our role model was Rod Serling, because he was the first great showrunner where the writer was at the top of the food chain. The writer decided what the show would be and what it would say. And so we've all followed that trajectory. Interestingly enough, many of these writers who went on to be the great showrunners of television science fiction read The Twilight Zone Companion, the book I wrote, when they were in their teens, And that made them want to become showrunners. Just, yeah, yes, yes. Just, well, just like I read The Making of Star Trek when I was a teenager, when I was 13, and that made me want to become a writer-producer in television. So it's, you can see there's this great lineage. There's this great tradition of passing it along, you know? And because I was in my early 20s when I wrote The Twilight Zone Companion, I started that book when I was 21. And, you know, it came out while I was still in my 20s. And so... So the people who read it and were inspired to become showrunners were not much younger than myself. You know, just like when I was writing for Smurfs, you know, again, I was in my 20s or He-Man or any of that stuff. And, you know, so so I you know, so this year marks my 50th year as a professional writer, but I started pretty young. So
yes, you did. You walked a path that few of us would have been able to.
Well, he has no breaks.
Yeah.
he has no hesitation, no imposter syndrome. He just, you know, barrels right in and does the thing.
Yeah. Well, it's very funny because Ray Bradbury and I became very good friends toward the end of his life. Once a month, I would go over to his house and we'd just sit and talk about life and career and art. And at one point, Ray said to me, you believe in yourself. So do I. You know, I mean, it was like you have confidence in your creative ability. And I'm certainly not comparing myself in ability to Ray Bradbury. He is, of course, a genius and unique. But yes, I've been, like I said earlier, I had a calling, a sense of what I wanted to do. And I've been very driven ever since. It was funny. Not long ago, I went to my elementary school reunion, and there were all these people. I knew all of them. I remembered all of them. Many I hadn't seen for 60 years. And they remembered that when I was a kid, my stepfather built me my own spaceship, and it was made out of Air Force surplus controls, and it had a picture of the Earth looking out the window, and I would give tours of the solar system to the other kids in the neighborhood. So I invited several of these kids I hadn't seen since elementary school to come to my studio, and they saw the spaceships and all that, and they said, "You haven't changed a bit." they said, "You have followed your dream," and they were very impressed, and that was
great. And you're still using used spaceship parts in your production.
I am.
We just sat down with the trailer, and you were talking about how you have. Set pieces and costumes from other shows and films that you're using in the Great Solar War, she said, switching to the current project.
I learned that lesson from Rod Serling. He, on Twilight Zone, he shot Twilight Zone at MGM, and he had access to every prop, set, backlot, everything MGM had ever made. So that's why I see everything from Forbidden Planet and
Twilight Forbidden Zone. Planet uniforms that show up three
exactly,
or four times.
Exactly.
I remember spotting those and going, hey!
Yes. Yes. And so and then when I was a producer on Sliders at Universal, I said, do we have access to everything Universal has ever made? And they said, well, we don't know. No one's ever asked that question. We'll find out. And they came back and they said, yes, you do. So we were using things from 12 Monkeys and Jurassic Park and Best Little Whorehouse in Texas and Time Cop. And it gave us much more production quality. And so with Space Command, we design and build a lot of stuff from scratch. We have a whole team of designers, and concept artists. But I also, every time a big budget science fiction TV show or movie ends, a number of those items go on auction from the various auction houses. So I'm on all of those email lists so we have things from everything from the original Twilight Zone and Outer Limits to Aliens and Prometheus and Ender's Game and Cloverfield Paradox and on and on and on and on. I just got a spacesuit from The Expanse and also another one from Tom Corbett Space Cadet because we use these things. We have spaceship consoles from Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes and the live action Thunderbirds and you name it. So it's quite remarkable. And as I said, we have three sound stages. One sound stage is an entire alien spaceship, so that's really cool.
Your alien spaceships are awesome, by the way. They're very alien.
Yeah, well, part of that comes from the fact that my degree from UCLA is painting, sculpture, and graphic arts. Growing up, I knew I'd either be a writer or a visual artist. I was doing both, and I got enrolled at UCLA, and so I was able to paint and sculpt and draw and all that stuff, and so I have a very strong visual sense, and so when I work with our designers, I have a very clear idea. And when I was talking to Eric Rodriguez, who designed our alien spaceship interior, I said, look, it has to be something we've never seen before. It can't look like H.R. Giger, because that's the trap that people fall into often, because H.R. Giger's designs in Alien were so strong and so...
Yeah, the biomech.
trope.
Right, yes, yes, that emblematic look that you've seen ripped off in so many movies. So I thought, okay, we've got to have something that I haven't seen before. Same thing with when we did the Space Command uniforms. My friend Ian McKay designed Darth Maul and Queen Amidala and the Mark Ruffalo Hulk and on and on. And I said, it can't be Star Trek and it can't be Star Wars. And so our uniforms look, they're our uniforms. And so it works. So I'm very, I really enjoy working with talented artists. And fortunately, I have the vocabulary. We speak the same language. And so it makes it very easy.
So how excited were your actors to put on their uniforms for the first time and show up on that bridge?
Oh, very, 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 very. And well, the fun part, again, this comes from being at the top of the food chain and not having to ask permission. You know, I knew I was going to be casting a lot of actors I'd worked with on Star Trek and Babylon 5 and so forth. So I knew I was casting Bill Mumy from Lost in Space and Babylon 5 and Bob Picard from Star Trek Voyager and, you know, Stargate Atlantis and Mira Furlan, my dear friend from Babylon 5, who sadly we lost during the pandemic, and Bruce Boxleitner and Doug Jones, the great Doug Jones from Star Trek Discovery and Shape of Water. So I knew I was going to be casting some very famous actors. So that allowed me, since we were raising our money from selling investment shares and from crowdfunding, I thought, well, why don't we do a worldwide talent search for two of our lead actors? Not just a walk-on, not just a single line, but one of the leads, too. So we put out a call for actors to audition for Captain Kemmer and Cadet Bradbury. And we got 12,000 inquiries, 7,000 video auditions. And we got 7,000 inquiries, 1,200 video auditions. And then we cast about 9 actors from those auditions.
That is a big pile of data to wade through.
But that's Hollywood, isn't it? You know,
how did you process 1,200
videos was a lot. So what we did was we had our team winnow it down to about 200, and then Elaine and I watched the 200, and then we ultimately selected Ethan McDowell to play Captain Kemmer. Now at the time he was from Wyoming, he was unknown. Now he's on Walking Dead, and he just came off Doom Patrol, and he was just shooting an episode of The Righteous Gemstones. So he's made it as an actor. And Brian McClure, who he cast as Lieutenant Bradbury, he was just on. He had a very major role in the thing that was on HBO with Jessica Lange as an actress who gets dementia. He was in that. So now they're having, you know, careers where you can see them in a lot of things. But at the time, you know, no one else was doing anything as audacious as that. But it's worked out wonderfully well. We're very happy with all of our actors.
It's just an astonishing journey, the whole thing from start to finish. When did you first get the idea that Space Command was going to be something that she wanted to do?
Yeah,
I think he was 10.
What was the last part, Susan?
I think you were 10 years old, weren't you?
Well, you know, it's funny. I always knew that I wanted to do a space-going show. I wanted to create and run a space-going show. But the real impetus for it was about 10 years ago, when a lot of the science fiction was very dystopic, very dark, where the mess, I mean, and as brilliant as Battlestar Galactica was, you sort of say, well, can't they ever have a birthday party? I mean, it was,
thank you. That's the problem I have with the new Galactica, is it's so dark. These people couldn't pull together to save their civilization.
Right,
they all
right.
hate each other.
Yeah, you know, the trouble with Babylon 5 is that it was about a dozen people about whom you couldn't give.
Babylon 5, you mean?
I mean,
Battlestar.
Not Battlestar Galactica, I'm sorry. The problem with Battlestar Galactica is it was full of people you didn't give a damn about.
Yeah, well, you know, and again, I really liked Galactica, but it was dark. It was a very dark show and a grim show. And then there were a lot of movies like Elysium and so forth. Again, good films, Oblivion, but very dark. The basic message was the future is going to be terrible and there's nothing you can do about it. Well, you know, I
can watch CNN for that.
Yeah,
well, I don't need it in my science fiction.
But see, here's the thing about the shows I grew up with. You know, both Rod Serling and Gene Roddenberry, neither of them was a cynic. Neither of them was a fatalist. They believed in humanity. They believed that we could create a future worth living in. I mean, Rod was writing cautionary tales with things like Monsters Who Do on Maple Street. And Roddenberry, my God, Roddenberry was saying we can create a future where we can come together, we can put aside our differences, we can create a future worth living in, a hopeful future. And people forget that the original Star Trek aired during the Vietnam War, during the riots in the cities, the civil rights movement. I mean, the cities were burning, but Roddenberry still had the courage to say we can make a better future. And he succeeded in that and inspired millions of people. So I wanted to do something that would be equally inspiring for now and that would have a similar message. And so that's where Space Command started. My wife, Elena, and I have been together 48 years, married 47. She's still the best part of every day. We write and direct and produce together. And she and I share that same vision. She comes out of the civil rights movement and out of, you know, a lot of the turmoil of the 60s. And yet she believes in people, as do I. My roundtable that I run every week is a perfect example of that, because the idea was always everyone is welcome who comes with a good heart. We don't get into politics. We don't get into religion. If you can come from any background, any ethnicity, any belief system, you have right or left or anything, as long as you come with a good heart and you're supportive of other people, and that's how you create a world worth living in. You know, you don't hear the phrase community much anymore, and people are not talked about as neighbors, you know. And I think it's really important to say, you know, we can put aside, we don't have to always be in political arguments. You know, I'm a liberal. I'm definitely on the left. I'm, you know, yay, Kamala. But, you know, but that's me. And I don't, and if some of my investors on Space Command are from the right, well, then we agree on enough to agree on. You know, it's like everyone wants their kids and their grandkids to grow up safe, to have possibilities, to have a future. You know, there's more similarity than difference, really, when you get down to it. And so I think it's very important for all of us not to polarize, but to see, to find common ground. And the common ground comes from here, from the heart, you know. And so, you know, and that's not Pollyannish and or naive at all, I don't think. So, you know, so and everything I've done in my life, I think, speaks to that.
And the wonderful thing about science fiction in general is that it is forward looking and it asks the question, what next?
Yes. You know? Yes. And that was why I loved the science fiction that I grew up reading, because, again, I grew up during the space race and during that era where the writers, I mean, you'd be watching TV and there's the moon landing and there's on TV is Ray Bradbury or Heinlein or Arthur C. Clarke talking about the space, you know, space exploration. And then you're reading their books about the same thing. It was a hopeful vision of the future where we would colonize Mars and jump to the stars and have possibility, the exploration of the universe and discoveries of the universe and land, you know, when Viking was landing on Mars and all of those things, this was all hopeful. And the fact that we haven't had a war in space, that we have collaborated and you know, helped each other in space, that's a good thing. That's remarkable.
I'm really looking forward to seeing what comes next. Ooh. One of the things that I'm just fascinated by is the sudden arrival of humanoid robots.
Yes.
Like,
that's
where the, we've been looking at this. I mean, Lester Del Rey in 1959 wrote The Runaway Robot, and it was a young adult novel, and it was my first science fiction book.
Yes.
And we've been looking at Isaac Asimov's vision of robotics for the future for half a century.
If you look at the robot in Metropolis, one of the great robots ever.
Oh yeah,
that's 100 years. That was, you know, 1925.
Yes,
and you know, so this has been a long held dream, but now, yeah, and AI, you know, with HAL 9000 and all of that. And the question really is, will we be able to keep them benign? And I
depends
I don't
who's
know.
Doing the programming.
We'll see what happens.
I've seen some of those robot dogs running around with these ridiculous semi-automatic weapons strapped to their backs. And you know, you look at them, and it looks like, oh well, it looks mean and nasty. But you look at it, and there's no way they could have rigged that to actually function, because where's all the support hardware that it takes to connect the gun to the robot? And it's not there.
Yeah, duct tape is not going to hold the thing
the Russian propaganda videos from 3 years ago, where they were looking at what robots were going to be and realizing that they had to get in front of the propaganda train, and they published these, they posted these videos of robots with weapons.
Yes.
And they looked great, but they didn't walk. And then you'd see another video and you'd find out why. Because mm-hmm. they couldn't keep their balance.
Well, they're working on the balance thing. I saw a video today of, it wasn't a whole robot, it was just kind of a framework. And a paraplegic man ran the Olympic torch today.
I saw that too.
And stepping and smiling.
Great.
But
that's great.
The difference between the predictions of science fiction and, you know, like what Susan was saying, it depends on who does the programming. And it's the thing is that humans will do all, given any given situation, humans will do all the things.
Yes, it's true.
There is no one path.
Well, there's a phrase that I coined not long ago, which is dysutopia, which is a combination of dystopia and utopia, which is what we're always living in. It's never one or the other. It's always a mixture of the two.
It's just utopia.
Yeah, dysutopia. And so because we have global warming, but we also have, you know, computers and we're speaking on Zoom, and there's a lot of miracles, but there's also a lot of dangers. And I think it's a very bad idea to build an autonomous killing machine, but we're going to get them. I'm sure we are. And on the other hand, it'll also serve you a burger, you know, so it's like, you know, yeah. So we just roll with it. We do our best and we, you know, but usually we're doing things, mankind is doing things that are just slightly out of control, you know, and that's, you know, that's the challenge, of course. And, you know, but again, you know, I grew up with the threat of the atom bomb and nuclear annihilation. And, you know, so that was, I was really the first generation that was born after man had the absolute ability to destroy the planet, which prior to World War II, we didn't have that ability. And so it's a amazing thing, you know, and thank God no one has blown up the world yet.
Well, people underestimate the boomers and the Generation Jones who mm-hmm. had to build all these computers. But yes. One thing the computer is good for, she said, changing back to the subject at hand, is Kickstarter.
Yay
Kickstarter. You have one. Let's talk about it.
Well, you know, Kickstarter has been very good to me. It, because of my roundtable, I mentor a lot of young people, and they'd started talking about crowdfunding about a decade ago. And I'd never raised money before. I'd just written for pretty much all the major studios and networks. But I thought, well, let's give this a try. My friends, some of my showrunner friends, when I came up with Space Command, said, let's take it in and get a pilot deal with one of the networks. And I didn't want to get cut off at script or cut off at pilot or have them wreck it because of their goofy notes, like, you know, put a clown in it or whatever. And, you know, so I thought, well, I've never raised money, but let's see if we can. And so our first campaign was, our target was $75,000 to raise in 2 months. We raised that in 3 days and then ultimately raised $221,000 in that first campaign. And that was enough to open my studio and start shooting. So so now we're raising another $50,000, hopefully 100 on this campaign to start shooting or continue shooting the new Space Command episode, Great Solar War. And that has, you know, Doug Jones in it and Bob Picardo and Bill Mumy and many, many, many wonderful actors. And, you know, we just shot the Space Command Forgiveness. We were able to get a scene with Nichelle Nichols before her passing, which was wonderful and remarkable. And I first met her when I was 10, when Star Trek was on the air. It was a dream come true to circle back after all those years. And, you know, so we've got the campaign going, Kickstarter, Space Command, Great Solar War. And, you know, if anyone wants to, you know, send some money our way, it's much appreciated.
And you can actually... when does it wrap up? How much time do we have?
It started now. How long does it run?
I think we have about 15 more days, something like that. And, you know, and so we're heading towards sort of the middle range right now.
Right.
And I have to call my investors. And yeah, you're just banging the drum. But I'm going to Comic-Con tomorrow. So we're doing a panel and a screening. And I can bang and tons of media interviews. And then I'm going to the Star Trek convention the week after. Mm-hmm. So a lot of opportunities to reach our fans. And so I'm, you know, cautiously optimistic. And but the lovely thing is, because we have our own studio, because we've sort of built this family of actors and so forth, that, you know, Space Command is a 12-hour season. We've shot the first 6 hours. We've started shooting hours 7 and 8. We will shoot the entire 12-hour season, definitely. And then we have 5 other series waiting in the wings that I'm creating with the creators of The Expanse and Farscape and so forth. So we have a we have a lot of on our plate, and it's very, very, very exciting. And
the five other series intrigues me. Is this an extension of Space Command or a total other story?
No, these are the other series are freestanding in their own universes, but we're creating an ensemble of actors. So, you know, for instance, the show I'm creating with Rockne O'Bannon, who created Farscape and Defiance and Sequest and Alienation and Cult and was most recently executive producer on Evil, we created a show called Sweet Haven. We actually came up with the idea before the pandemic, but the basic idea is a bioengineered disease that gets out of control and kills everyone in the world under 60. So the people 60 and above have to figure out how to save humanity when they can't reproduce. And it's a very interesting idea. And so we've got Robert Picardo in it and Gates McFadden and Veronica Cartwright and Ethan Phillips and James Hong and talking to George Takei about being in it and just a bunch of some of our favorite actors. And the reason I wanted to do it was because I think one of the few stereotypes that still exists is, you know, old people, you'll see, you know, they have to play like characters who are like funny grandpa or funny grandma or someone coming down with dementia. It's like, well, most of the people I know over 60 are still very much in the game, very much active and passionate and involved, committed. And I wanted to show that side. Barbara Bain is in it. Barbara Bain is in her 90s now.
Oh,
and she's
wow.
That.
How old is she?
She's in her 90s. I think she's 93, something like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Phenomenal.
Wow.
Phenomenal people. And so Rock and I and Elaine and I wrote the screenplay. Rock and I have planned out the show, the season. And, you know, and we're just getting ready to shoot it. Michael Harney's in as well. He comes off Orange is the New Black and Project Blue Buck, just a phenomenal actor. And, you know, and again, it's just like, okay, rock and roll. And then we're doing Magic Time, which is based on a series of novels that I wrote. And we're doing Fugitive Space, which is about the military-industrial prison complex in the future, and when we encounter an alien race. There's just tons of fun stuff ahead. You know, but the fun part is that when you have your own studio, you can mix and match, you can repurpose sets, you can redress them. And as I said, we're creating an ensemble of actors. So I'll say to Ethan McDowell or to, you know, whomever, you know, any of these actors. Christina Moses is a dear friend of mine. She played Sulu's daughter in the Star Trek New Voyages episode we did with George Takei, and then she went on to star in A Million Little Things on ABC, and she's in Space Command coming up, and she's also going to be in, you know, some of these other projects as well. You know, so it's fun. Actors like the opportunity to be in different roles, but it's also they love an environment that's encouraging and there's no bullshit at all, none. You know, so it's great fun, just total creativity.
That sounds transformative. I would have loved to have worked in that kind of environment when I was still doing work at the studio.
Well, who says you can't? I mean, he's promoting people over 60.
Greenlighting yourself. I mean, the fun part is, many of my mentors, it was very interesting. When Ray Bradbury and I became friends, when he was in his 80s and then into his 90s, And I studied him as basically a role model to show me how to be old and still be incredibly creative. He was an astonishing man.
Yes,
and he was.
When I knew him, he'd already had a stroke. He could no longer type. So what he would do is he would wake up in the morning holding the words in his head. He would call his daughter in Arizona and dictate the words. She would then type them up, fax them back to him, and he would make hand corrections. And that's how he wrote for the entire time I knew him. He was writing two new books a year.
Wow.
Till the end. And he had the best writing schedule of anyone I ever knew. He would, Monday through Friday, he would write in the mornings, then have lunch, then take a nap, and then do business in the afternoons, and evenings and weekends were for the family. And he did that for over 70 years. That was his method. And just amazing, amazing man. Phenomenal.
I heard it said that he never edited what he wrote. He published his first draft of practically.
No, that's not true at all.
I don't think that's
true. No, the way Ray worked at the beginning of his career is on Monday he would sit down, and he used to say vomit then mop, which meant you pour it out, then you edit it, okay? And so he would sit down, and in one sitting he would write an entire short story. Then what he would do, so that was on Monday. On Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, he would revise the story, polish it, and then on Friday he would mail it to his agent in New York, and then he'd start all over again on Monday. So 50 weeks a year, he would be writing, he would essentially write 50 stories, most of which were selling, and then he'd take off like 2 weeks for vacation. But that's how he started his career. Now, as his career grew and he started doing novels and screenplays and so forth, then he, you know, was more adaptive to what the requirements of the assignment were. But he was always working, always writing. And some books, he told me some books took 50 years to write. There's one book that he published, and he said, I wrote this originally for Katharine Hepburn, but by the time I finally finished it, she was dead. You know, so so he was quite something, and an incredibly charming man, brilliant man.
Well, I'm very happy to be wrong about that, because I find it very encouraging. You know,
Roger Zelazny, who was one of my teachers at Clarion, he told me that he was unable to rewrite according to notes. What he would do is he would write a first draft, and then when he got notes, he'd throw the entire draft out, start over again, and write a version that had those notes incorporated. But he could not go through a manuscript and tweak it here and there. He didn't have that ability, so that was pretty amazing.
Well,
but
when you think about it, it's when you have that many details to track,
yes.
I mean, the writing I'm doing, I'm using AI to help me remember what I said in what parts of the book, because I don't freaking remember.
Yeah, but that's
after
as easy.
80,000 words.
Yeah, but that can be as simple as a search function of what did
well,
you know,
yeah.
You know, Uncle Elmer say to Auntie,
yes.
Auntie Brew, you know?
Well, I remember there was one year that Philip K. Dick wrote 12 novels in that year.
Oh,
and so there's a book he wrote called The Zap Gun, where it's clear at the end that he doesn't remember what he wrote at the beginning. Like, it contradicts itself.
Oh, and here we thought it was the drugs.
Yeah, amphetamines, absolutely. But he was quite. There's so many amazing people working in science fiction. Just these huge talents. You know, it's really great.
Well, we are talking to one of those huge talents right now, ladies and gentlemen. We have been talking to Mark Scott Zikri, the creator of Space Command, and a whole bunch of other new stuff coming up. And there's a Kickstarter, which you should invest in. Because this is good stuff coming up.
Information on that Kickstarter will appear on our webpage with this story.
Well, thank you so much. Well, see, this is the fun thing. The collaboration is between me and the audience. So, you know, when I was a little kid, I was outside NBC with my little sign saying, the new Star Trek for a third season. You know, I was like 10 years old, out at night, but past my bedtime with the others, you know, Bijo Trimble. People, but back then we got a third season of Star Trek because a million people sent in letters, including myself, and so there was a sense that we as an audience could actually have a say, and The Expanse got renewed because of the fans, mm-hmm. and you know, so, but this is even more direct because it's basically my audience and I create these shows, they finance them, and so between Kickstarter and with Space Command, I was selling shares for $7,500 each. People would get a percentage of my producer's net profits. And we have a number of investors. And then recently with this new project where it's six series and a feature, that's called the Showrunners Network. And it includes Space Command. It's all those other series I was mentioning, including a new Rod Serling series that I'm talking to the family about. And that, we've just started offering shares in that, and that's a big bite. That's $105,000 a share because it's such a bigger project. But already we have two investors. So, you know, it's like it turned out I had a knack for raising money, which I didn't know until Space Command, because I never had to do it. I never tried to do it. But what I find is that, you know, I'm the same as my fans. I've been very lucky that way. If something engages me, generally my fans will like it too. And, you know, so it's just super fun. And, you know, I'll come up with some crazy science fiction idea, and my team will sort of, the blood will drain from their face when I tell them it. And then we'll figure out how to do it. You know, it's really cool. It's really fun.
Well, thank you for joining us on this week's episode of The Event Horizon. It has been, it's been a hoot.
Well, thanks so much, guys. I really appreciate it. And I'm very glad that you're doing what you're doing. And, you know, science fiction is a wonderful big tent for us all to play in. And, I wouldn't have it any other way. So we'll talk to you next time, and thanks again.
You have been listening to episode 275 of Sci-Fi.Radio's production of The Event Horizon for July 27th, 2024. Our guest this evening has been Mark Scott Zikri, prolific producer and screenwriter and creator of the independent science fiction web TV series Space Command. The show will air again tomorrow, July 28th, 2024, at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, and again on the upcoming Thursday and Saturday mornings at 4 a.m. Pacific, 7 a.m. Eastern. After all the airtimes have passed, you will find this episode and others on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podbay FM, Pandora, Stitcher, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, and on our own website at sci-fi.radio. If you enjoyed the programming you have just heard, please consider visiting patreon.com/sci-fi-radio and become a patron of the station. We are listener-supported sci-fi and fantasy fandom radio, and your contributions go to paying our DJs, our production team, the writers for our Geek News website, our business operation fees, our music licensing, and much, much more. We have been broadcasting continuously since 2009, and we are thankful for the support of listeners just like you. That URL again is patreon.com/sci-fi-radio. The Event Horizon on sci-fi.radio. It's sci-fi for your Wi-Fi.